This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 30th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the Army releases findings after a 15-month-long study on soldier suicides, which have grown to their highest rates since the Vietnam War. We'll go to Michigan and find out how local communities are responding to the oil spill in the Kalamazoo River.
Today I saw a muskrat crawling out of the water, out of the bushes, covered in oil.
And Bangladesh garment workers fight for better wages and safety standards.
They're blasting sand at jeans, and then the sand breaks down into a fine dust, gets inside the lungs, and people get silicosis.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Congress today took up the Consolidated Land, Energy, and Aquatic Resources, or CLEAR Act, a bill in response to the BP oil disaster. The bill would eliminate the liability cap on the amount oil companies have to pay after a spill or other accident. It would also raise the oil production tax from 8 cents to as much as 49 cents per barrel, and it would require that all oil rigs used in the U.S. be built, owned, and operated by U.S. companies. Many Republicans say the bill doesn't raise taxes on foreign oil companies and say increased costs to domestic producers will allow foreign companies to remain cheaper and more competitive. Colorado Republican Representative Doug Lamborn.
It's not just on offshore oil and gas production, but on onshore federal lands. So it goes way beyond the discussion we're having about the Gulf. It's going to add up to $22 billion and this is not the time to be raising taxes on energy. We're trying to come out of a recession.
The House is also debating the Offshore Oil and Gas Worker Whistleblower Protection Act. Currently, people working on offshore rigs like the Deepwater Horizon have no whistleblower protections. At press time, lawmakers had not yet voted on the bills. Phoenix police arrested about 50 people Thursday who protested the controversial immigration bill, including former state senator Alfredo Gutierrez. Dozens of other demonstrations took place across the country in protest of Senate Bill 1070. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio conducted another of his sweeps in a Phoenix neighborhood Thursday, arresting 42 people, including 3 undocumented immigrants. Sheriff Arpaio says he's planning another sweep this afternoon. The U.S. consulate in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, is closed following what security officials say was a credible threat. It will remain closed until a new security review is completed. 3 people tied to the U.S. consulate were killed in March. Meanwhile, 1 of 4 Mexican reporters kidnapped on Monday in the wake of a major corruption scandal has been released as their captors make editorial demands on national media outlets. Shannon Young has the story.
Televisa cameraman Hector Gordoa was kidnapped in broad daylight along with 2 other colleagues after leaving a state prison at the center of a major corruption scandal tying prison authorities to drug traffickers. A statewide newspaper reporter was kidnapped later that night. The kidnappers later demanded the broadcast of a number of propaganda videos aimed at rival narco-traffickers, marking apparently the first time that Mexican cartels have made direct editorial demands on national outlets. Televisa's Denise Merker suspended the broadcast of her program this week due to the conditions of insecurity. The public affairs host said that she and her crew were, quote, unwilling to go on the air to pretend like nothing is happening. The announcement is perhaps another first in which a powerful national broadcaster openly acknowledges the self-censorship that has become a common practice for many journalists here. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
The UN's Treaty on Cluster Bombs will go into effect this Sunday, 6 months after it was ratified by the necessary 30 countries. The Convention on Cluster Munitions has been signed by 107 nations. The U.S., China, Russia, Brazil, and Israel have not. Russia, Israel, and the U.S. are all nations that have used cluster bombs in the last decade. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev signed into law expanded powers for the Federal Security Service, or FSB, that will allow it to increase surveillance on citizens. As Jenny Johnson reports, opposition groups fear the new powers are meant to further restrict their activities.
Under the new powers, the FSB can give warnings, extract fines, or arrest any citizen suspected of participating in extremist activities that threaten national security. Some analysts are calling attention to the vague wording of the law, which allows the FSB to act if it views someone as creating the conditions for a crime to be committed, without defining what such conditions would be. The new powers can be used against anyone suspected of committing a crime in the future. The expanded powers come as grassroots groups are routinely denied the right to hold public events in opposition to current policies. The monthly rallies of a group organized to draw attention to the right of assembly clause in the Constitution have never been officially sanctioned by authorities. And gay and lesbian rights groups are also among those regularly denied permits to hold rallies. Supporters of the law say the new powers are aimed at defending against attacks from terrorist groups, the most recent being in the Moscow metro in March, which killed 40. Jenny Johnson, FSRN, Russia.
The parents of three Americans being held in Iran held a vigil outside the Iranian mission to the UN in New York. It's one of several protests planned to mark 1 year since the hikers were detained by Iranian authorities. Iran said they crossed from Iraq onto Iranian soil and accused the three of spying. In May, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said it would be up to a judge to decide whether the three are telling the truth about their intentions and whether they will be freed. And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. This month has been the deadliest on record for U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The deaths of three troops Friday in Kabul bring the total to 63 in July. The Army is also looking into other causes of death among soldiers. In a lengthy report released Thursday, the Army examined the rising rate of suicides among active duty soldiers. The study puts the blame on commanders for ignoring problems until they're too late. Tanya Snyder reports.
Coleman Bean was home from his second tour of duty in Iraq when he killed himself in September 2008. His father, Gregory, says after each deployment, he came back changed.
He started having anxiety attacks, loss of focus, inappropriate, just outbursts of sometimes anger. We thought he was drinking too much.
He says Coleman tried to seek help from the VA, but was first told he wasn't eligible for help. And then the VA kept canceling appointments.
A lot of servicemen, active duty and discharged, can't or won't reach out to the VA or find that process too cumbersome or unsatisfactory, or they don't get what they need, or it's just too daunting.
The new Army report reveals that there were a record 160 suicides among active duty soldiers in the last fiscal year, from October 2008 to September 2009. If you include other self-destructive behaviors like substance abuse and drinking and driving, the report finds more soldiers die by their own actions than die in combat. The 350-page report downplayed the importance of multiple deployments on the rate of suicide, saying that 79% of those who committed suicide had been deployed just once or not at all.
I don't believe it. There's no way you can make me believe it.
Again, Gregory Bean.
Multiple deployments take a terrible toll on these young men and women. And for the Army to suggest that it doesn't, that's almost shameful.
Others agree. Pacifica contributor Aaron Glantz, author of The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, says the military is trying to shift the focus away from the war.
You've seen generals speak at conferences and talk about, you know, people committing suicide in Iraq because they got a Dear John letter back from San Francisco. And there's some truth to that, but I also have to think the military is trying to pass the buck. The military is trying to shift the blame.
Besides, many people who have been deployed multiple times are then discharged, and the suicide rate of veterans is far higher than for active duty officers. Once they leave the controlled environment of the Army and are no longer among people who can relate to their experiences, mental health issues begin to surface.
The Army is working with only a portion of that overall statistical universe, right? And so it's able to say, hey, in our little statistical universe, it's not the main cause, right? Because they're the same people. It's not like it's two different sets of human beings. The people who are now veterans used to be in the Army.
There are other ways that multiple deployments can aggravate the problem. The Army's only meeting its recruiting standards because it keeps lowering them, and the country has been unwilling to institute a draft. So when recruitment is down, commanders have no choice but to send into combat troops whom they know are unfit, whom they know are having psychological problems.
He can't tell them all, you know what, I'm going to help you get out of the Army. He's got to get them to train up for the next deployment. That's his job.
Suicide isn't the whole picture either. The report cites 146 active duty deaths related to risky behavior, including 74 drug overdoses. At a news conference, Army Vice Chief of Staff Peter Corelli said he's been frustrated that he hasn't been able to get more healthcare specialists to deal with it.
Now I'm having one heck of a time getting the numbers I need at the different post camps and stations that I need to handle what I think is a higher rate of substance abuse today than 8 years ago.
The use of prescription drugs to keep mental illness in check is also increasing. According to the report, between 2005 and 2008, the number of soldiers who were prescribed antidepressants grew from 1% to 5%. Despite the sobering numbers, military families and others commend the Army for investigating the problem seriously and announcing the findings so publicly. They say it's reassuring that the Army is done trying to sweep the problem under the rug. Tanya Snyder, FSRN, Washington.
We turn now to Michigan, where containment efforts continue after a damaged pipeline leaked hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil into the Kalamazoo River. We're joined by Danielle Korpalski, Midwest Regional Outreach Coordinator with the National Wildlife Federation. Welcome to FSRN.
Great, thank you. Happy to be here.
Today, you visited the Kalamazoo River. Tell us what you saw.
Well, you know, I have to say the first thing you see is actually the smell. From about a quarter of a mile away, it is a really pungent smell, and you know you're closely approaching the river. And so I would say, just for folks, that is the first thing you notice, the first piece of evidence that there has been a spill. And then from there, moving, you know, toward the riverbanks, I mean, the top of the water is just covered in oil. You can see it moving rapidly down the river, and alongside each bank of the river is just blackened, again, from this oil. It's really devastating. I mean, there's a lot of locals congregating around the river and just observing the impacts. Today I saw a muskrat crawling out of the water, out of the bushes, covered in oil, which was, again, heartbreaking. So there have been lots of geese I've seen as well, and fish that have already rolled up dead from the oil spill.
Well, you mentioned the smell. The county health department there said it has been visiting homes, and some residents have really complained of the air quality, and there may have been some evacuations in the area. What's the latest on evacuations there?
Well, what we have heard also from the EPA and from other government officials is that they're evacuating folks within 200 feet of the river. And I actually spoke to some locals today who said they were just outside the 200 feet, but that it's still a very toxic smell. And so they were trying to get a hold of the EPA and of the DNR, the state DNR, to figure out what the plan was for them, because they were just outside the boundary that they've set. But they, you know, claim that it's still extremely toxic, which it is.
Now, according to Enbridge, the oil company that is responsible for this spill, 819,000 gallons have leaked from the pipe. The EPA put that number around 1 million before. The company has also said that it has contained the leak, but reporters from the Detroit Free Press said that as late as Thursday evening, oil was still visible. And from your account today, you have seen oil flowing on the Kalamazoo River. What are the containment efforts like at this point?
Absolutely. Well, I would like to make a distinction about the word containment. I think there's some confusion, and I was talking to folks as well on the ground. And, you know, I think there's sort of a three-prong approach to this issue. And there's containment, and then there's actual physical cleanup, and then restoration. So, you know, it might be contained, but the cleanup is, you know, we still have a long way to go on that.
This is an especially serious spill in the region. The Battle Creek vice mayor called it a disaster. But National Wildlife Federation released a report yesterday that identified 61 serious spills over the past decade in Michigan. Now, with the BP oil spill in the Gulf, the focus has been lately on disasters in the source, where the source of oil is from. But talk about the dangers of spills or accidents on land in that region.
You know, I would say that the spill on land and in our fresh water is extremely detrimental. The Great Lakes rely on the rivers and streams and wetlands to be clean in order to keep the Great Lakes healthy and clean. And so it's extremely devastating that we've taken a few steps back because of this spill. But I think this really highlights a much larger message in connection from this oil spill to the BP catastrophe and to Valdez up in Alaska. It's we need to do something about the way we produce and the way we use energy. This is going to continue to happen. It's going to continue to devastate lives and to devastate ecosystems until we make a conscientious decision to change the way we produce and use energy.
Danielle Korpalski is with the National Wildlife Federation. She was at the Kalamazoo River today, and she joined us to talk about the oil spill in the area and the effect on the local communities and wildlife there. Thank you for speaking with us.
Absolutely. I'm happy to get the message out to everyone.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed a bill this week that would have given farm workers paid overtime after working more than 40 hours a week. Currently, California law only requires time and a half for farm workers after 10 hours a day or 60 hours a week. Recently, United Farm Workers launched a campaign called Take Our Jobs, daring American citizens and legal residents to take jobs doing farm work. Our colleague Dolores M. Bernal took that challenge and files this reporter's notebook from the San Joaquin Valley in Central California.
I woke up at 4 in order to get to Delano, California by 6 a.m. to be a farm worker for a day. I wore boots and a long-sleeved shirt, thinking I was prepared for the challenge of working all day in California's vineyards. When I arrive, there are grapevines as far as the eye can see.
Buenos dias.
I then meet Hilario Martinez, one of the foremen at the farm.
And how many people usually come here to work?
Well, right now between 30 to 35, but when harvesting starts, it's usually 60.
I see other women arrive. They have their faces and heads covered with bandanas to cover them from the dirt, spiders, and worms that hide on the grape leaves. My work? Take off the leaves from the vine so that in August the farm workers can get better access to the thousands of bunches of grapes. My partner for the day is Fries Sierra, an immigrant from Mexico who has been working these farms for 10 years to support her four children.
You work so fast.
Do you think so?
Oh my gosh, I've only taken out like 5 leaves. What's the most difficult part of the work? The arms must hurt after a while, huh?
Yes, the arms and the neck hurt after trying to reach the tall branches all day.
Farm workers like Fries work 6 days a week at $8 per hour. These workers don't get any overtime pay or benefits. As the sun gets higher, the heat begins to increase. About 11 farm workers have died over the past 5 years from heat exhaustion in the San Joaquin Valley alone. Thankfully, these vineyards offer some shade. Santos Montemayor hires the farm workers. I approach him to ask if Latinos are the only ones working here.
I haven't had one single white person come to me to work on the fields.
And what about African Americans?
No African Americans either, ever.
Also in the fields today is Armando Elenes, the National Vice President of the United Farm Workers. I ask him to explain what the Take Our Jobs campaign is all about.
Bueno, mirando tantos comentarios negativos.
Well, we've been hearing all these negative comments that immigrants are taking away American jobs. They argue that this is why we should deport the undocumented. But we believe that this isn't true. So we consulted with some farm worker leaders to come up with this idea.
Well, it didn't last very long. After about 5 hours of work, I say goodbye to Fries and to the other farm workers. When I get home, I get into bed to sleep the rest of the day away, not even caring about the layer of dirt covering my face. For now, I doubt that I will ever go back to work in the fields again. At least, not for a very long, long time. Dolores M. Bernal, FSRN, Delano, California.
In the Northern California mountains, the Winnemem-Wintu tribe has revived an ancient ceremony for young women. But the federally unrecognized tribe is having difficulties accessing their ancestral lands, which are held in public trust today and have become a popular site for water recreation. FSRN's Christina Anastad files this report.
Along the McLeod River, a scenic tributary of the Mount Shasta Dam, the Winnemem-Wintu tribe gather for a traditional ceremony. Men dance and sing around a sacred fire that will burn for 4 days and nights. This is a puberty ceremony, and it honors a girl's transition into womanhood. Kalene Sisk Franco is chief and spiritual leader of the Winnemem-Wintu.
We call it the Bathos Chonas, which means that we are bringing our girls into a culture that really demands that they be connected. And when they all come together, they all dance. They're all waiting for the young girls to come back as young women. And when they do, there is a place for them. And there is a belonging that happens.
This is the second time in more than 8 decades the Winnemem-Wintu have returned to their ancestral land to hold the ceremony. In the 1940s, during World War II, Congress removed the Wintu from the land to build the Mount Shasta Dam. In the process, most of their villages were flooded. Now the area is open to recreational boating and fishing. Sisk Franco says holding a ceremony on their sacred land is a challenge since boaters now use the waterways.
We should have an indigenous right to have and to hold our ceremonies in privacy. It's not on display. It's not a show. It's not a demonstration for people to come and look at.
Sisk Franco says the recreational users of the area often consume alcohol, which is disruptive to their ceremony. Because the Winnemem-Wintu are unrecognized by the federal government, the U.S. Forest Service refuses to close the waterway to recreational boaters. Instead, they're issuing a voluntary river closure. While most boaters appear to honor the request, there are some onlookers that speed by in their motorized boats, watching as two young girls make the transition from pubescence into adulthood on the banks of the river. Mark Franco is war chief of the Winnemem-Wintu tribe.
We're out here trying to maintain our lifeway in the best way that we know how, as humbly as we can, and doing that in a society that surrounds us that doesn't really have an understanding of what a ceremony really means.
Although the U.S. Forest Service has refused to close the recreational area during their ceremony, the tribe says they'll continue to pressure the government to protect their land and ceremonies. Christina Onnestad, FSRN, Northern California.
In Bangladesh's capital, Dhaka, thousands of garment workers protested the government's decision to double wages to $43 a month, saying the rise was inadequate. Events turned violent, and The Guardian reports several injured and scores more detained. The conflict coincides with a rising call for improved conditions in the garment industry, including sandblasting jeans, a practice banned in Turkey after 600 ex-textile workers fell seriously ill from breathing silica dust in the workplace. FSRN's Jacob Resnick visited both Turkey and Bangladesh and files this report.
Anna McMullen is a UK-based labor activist allied with the Clean Clothes Campaign. She says studies of textile workers in Turkey proved that sandblasting could be deadly to workers who breathe the dust from the machines.
Sandblasting came to the attention of CCC about 6 months to a year ago when we came across some unions in Turkey who had found that workers were dying where they're blasting sand at jeans, and then the the sand breaks down into a fine dust, gets inside the lungs, and people get silicosis.
Silicosis is caused by particles of silica, that's silicon dioxide, entering the lungs and doing irreparable damage to lung tissue. Usually silicosis is only seen among miners and stone workers. It was here in Istanbul, Turkey, where doctors first made the connection between silicosis and textile workers. Now there are about 600 confirmed cases and at least 44 deaths linked to sandblasting in the textile sector. That led the Turkish government to ban the practice last year. It was public pressure that forced the government's hand. Yasin Yasim researches public health at Istanbul University. She was one of the campaigners that lobbied the Turkish health ministry to ban sandblasting. She's pushing for an international ban because she says the problem hasn't gone away. It's moved east.
Now it's in Bangladesh, as far as we know, where the labor regulations are poor, where the labor force is huge, and the life of human beings are relatively cheaper, quote unquote.
Bangladesh is the most densely populated country and also one of the poorest. Sitting in a chaotic traffic jam outside the capital city, Dhaka, labor organizer Nazma Akhtar complains of lax health and safety protections in Bangladesh. She says the dangers of sandblasting are largely unknown among garment workers who labor in the plants.
Lots of diseases come out from the sandblasting. It's not good for the health. And even the factory is not providing enough protective things. Some other factory I found, they are not using their personal protective equipment, or even the factory is not providing. Sometimes they're showing something for the buyers. These are problems I'm facing.
In an industrial suburb, I visit a backstreet workshop where denim jeans are being sandblasted. This small operation works around the clock with three young men at a time blasting jeans. It turns out 150,000 pairs of jeans a month, using about 2,200 cubic feet of silica-rich river sand to do so. That's according to the friendly foreman, who seems oblivious to the health risks his workers are exposed to. As the sandblasters toil in a corrugated metal shack, it's a cacophony of noise and dust. Only a cotton rag wound over their faces protects these workers, but health experts agree it will do little to prevent them from inhaling dangerous levels of silica dust. The owner says his workshop finishes jeans that will later be branded for household names like The Gap and H&M, but it's virtually impossible to verify his claims, and these brands deny they use subcontractors or buy jeans that have been sandblasted with silica-rich sand.
Any factory that makes our products have to adhere to comprehensive, strict standards. It's frankly just non-negotiable.
That's Daniel Rubin, a Gap representative in San Francisco. He says Gap employs a team of auditors that regularly investigate factories to make sure they comply with the company's codes of conduct.
We're committed to, you know, protecting workers and the factories that make our products and the communities in which they live and work, because at the end of the day, beyond it being what's right, I mean, it's also good for business, too.
An H&M representative in Sweden also denied it sources sandblasted jeans, noting that it contravenes the company's policies. Mustafizur Rahman of the Center for Policy Dialogue, a think tank in Dhaka, credits global fashion brands for enforcing health and safety standards above and beyond required by the government. But he also says brands' aggressive push to keep prices low gives factory owners an incentive to cut corners. The answer, he says, is for brands to ensure a premium is paid to suppliers who adhere to ethical health and safety standards.
If it is not given but the pressure is there, then the competitive edge is undermined. And oftentimes when these requirements leads to higher prices, the brands try to pass that on to the entrepreneurs.
In addition to health and safety issues, textile wages fall well below the poverty line. Earlier this year, a dozen companies, including The Gap, H&M, and Walmart, called on the Bangladesh government to revisit the wage issue. These issues are leading to increased political and economic instability. Less than 1% of garment workers are unionized, and the workers have few credible leaders. Rahman says that's a dangerous combination.
If there is some commotion or turmoil in our industrial belt, there is not a single entity which can really, you know, control the agitation or could sit on behalf of the workers with the entrepreneurs.
The government is appealing for workers' patience, but there are fears that public anger will continue to boil over as grievances mount. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Dhaka.
Mm-hmm.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Dorian Marina in New York.